And I says, "Mister, there's no numbers on this check." And he said, "You write in there whatever you want." And I realized right then, I get goosebumps right now thinking about it. I says, "My God, I made it." That's what any artist would just love to hear, is a blank check for their work and to go ahead and fill in whatever they want for it. Started to do a little dance. I says, "I knew that somebody was going to come along and appreciate this after 10 years of study to give me a blank check for it." And obviously he's a very influential person. He's wealthy. I can write the check for whatever I want.
Hi there, it's Michael Senoff here with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com and the Money Shot News. I've got an incredible, incredible interview for you. It's a six-part interview with Mike, the garage sale guy. You can read the description on your July 15th Money Shot News subscription and stick with it. This guy's an absolute genius. Each one of his stories is a master lesson in business, marketing, license, and hustle. I hope you enjoy. Now let's get going. I've always thought you'd be a great story because I have a good eye for entrepreneurs and unique ways of making money. And I knew you were one. And I want to thank you for allowing me to pick your brain and just sharing some of the stories, because I have listeners from all over the world and everyone needs to make money. Everyone needs new ideas. Everyone needs fresh ideas. There are some books you can learn, but people who are out there hustling on the street, these are the best educators in the world. And I believe you're one of them. Tell us your name and where you're originally from.
My name is Mike Johnson, and I'm from Chicago, Illinois, originally. Parents were both instructors. My dad was a DI for the Marine Corps, a drill instructor, and my mom was a school teacher for 40 years and focused on just teaching kids that were 7 years old, because that's the point where either make or break and lose them or gain them as possible potential students in the future.
So she liked that age?
Yeah, that's the age that you can be manipulated into loving school or hating it.
Yeah, was it private or public school?
Always public schools, which is a struggle because they always want to reset you into different environments, you know, for a constant change of attitudes so that you don't get stuck in one rhythm. But she wanted to stay where she can be more helpful to more students. She's helped 10,000 students in her lifetime, and most of them would come back as adults and say, "My God, you were the teacher that changed my life."
She really was a great teacher.
Yeah, well, she had me to deal with. So she says, "Man, there's other kids like this. There's got to be a need, you know."
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have three sisters, and they were very easily to retain information from books and studies and stuff. And I have a sister that got a double major or a doctorate in English and teaching. So she also went on to do the same career choices as my mom and whatever. So they were influenced by it. But unfortunately, we grew up in a very poor family. You know, they were working all the time, and they had kids to deal with and payments and stuff. So it was at a time when there was no such thing as an abandonment law. They didn't have problems with children being left at places or basically babysitted by other things, you know. So my parents thought it was totally okay to take me every day to the different museums and zoos and amusement parks in Chicago and leave us there for the day.
Your sisters as well?
No, they usually went different directions, you know, like they had other people that were wanting them to do stuff for them, so they would have them stay at their house and maybe watch other siblings or, you know, do something of the nature. But my mom and dad couldn't afford a whole lot of child care, and there wasn't any babysitters or anybody to sit us, basically, so they just dropped me off at the museum. Say, "Here you go to the Field Museum of Chicago," and they give me $2 or $3 to eat lunch, and I was really young. I was only probably 5 or 6 years old, 5 probably, and they said, "When the big hands on the 12 and the little hands on the 6, you'd be right here, or we're going to leave you in the museum overnight."
How long did that go on for?
Oh, for years, maybe 2 or 3 years, I imagine.
So you must have learned that museum inside and out.
Well, you know, it was a really amazing thing. I was a small child, whatever, 5, 6, and I think at the very end it was about 7. And what I would do, I remember I'd say, "Okay, they're going to drop me off right now." And sometimes I would run as fast as I could just to see the end of the museum. It just went on and on endlessly, you know, from floor after floor and wing after wing. So I just wanted to see the whole thing. So I remember attempting to run as fast as I could, and I would run for 4 hours.
To try and get it all in.
Yeah, to take it all in. And at the same time, I didn't make it. I don't remember, even to this day, I don't know how big that museum actually is, because I would get 4 hours into it, and then I realized I have to get back because I have to be back by the 6, you know. So I would take off and go back the other direction to try to retrace my steps. You know, I remember being in front of huge, giant exhibits. One of my favorite was the giant T-Rex dinosaurs, you know, bones and all the different effects with the different dinosaur exhibits and stuff that they had, which were numerous. And a couple times I got stuck in the museums. At one time at the Art Museum in Chicago, I was past my time. I locked onto Jackson Pollock. And I was standing on the little bench in front of the painting itself. And so I was standing on the bench. My mother said she came into the museum, was looking for me because I wasn't there at the allotted time. And so the museum was going to close and she had to go find me. So she was looking up every wing and going every direction. She found me in front of Pollock. And I think I might have been just standing on the bench and just crying looking at the painting because it's just absolutely moving. You know, the thing is just amazing. You know, how that become what it is or whatever is just a phenomenon to me. So I studied that as I grew up or whatever. I tried to understand Pollock's thinking and where he's coming from with all of it. But she says, what are you doing? And I said, well, look at that, Mom. That's just amazing. It's the best piece in the whole museum, but it's just basically dripped paint. You know, and he just walks around and dripped paint in his driveway and covered canvases that were huge, giant pieces or whatever.
So do you think he had a method to his madness, his paintings?
Well, the thing is, they have actual film of him painting. You can see on YouTube how he actually painted and stuff. And how the story goes, I try to read a little bit about it. And, of course, my mother would find different things about him. I even have, to this day, postcards and things that have his work on it, you know, to kind of refresh me where it was all coming from. But he would drip paint. At first, he would dip a brush and then put it onto the canvas. And then that wasn't fast enough to accomplish what he wanted, so he started to paint by throwing it. He'd take the paint out of the can with the paintbrush and throw it at the canvas so that it would get there quicker, because dribbling is kind of a long process, you know. So then eventually, he would just put a can opener on it and open it up in several different holes and pour it out of the can onto the canvas because it's faster. But basically, he would continue to do it until some point where he was satisfied with it being complete. I know for a fact that one of his things was to cover the entire canvas so that you couldn't see the beginning work. You couldn't see where he started from and where he ended up. It had to be completely covered up. I also read about him that it says that at some point, I think as the fourth piece or third piece he accomplished, there were huge pieces the size of a driveway, obviously maybe the size of four square cars or some of the size of the canvas. It must take months to dry it, too. I mean, you think of all that poured paint. So anyway, so he stood it up in front of his wife or whatever and asked her, is this art? He didn't ask, is this good art? Is it something you like? He just asked, is this art? I don't remember the answer to that, but I thought that was kind of interesting that he was unsure of himself even to that point after three of them being sold, that it was even art. I think it was a joke at first. He just wanted to see what people would step into because they read into the art different forms and different images that he really didn't put there. He just dribbled the paint, you know. So eventually they say, well, look at that elephant over there and that sausage, whatever it is. And he didn't put that in there on purpose. It just shows up because of the patterns, the random quantum patterns.
How many paintings did he do, do you know?
About 50 paintings, and 49 of them were accepted or purchased by museums, which leaves only one painting that's still being traded and sold through private dealers. And right now, the painting is worth $800 million.
Do you know how he sold his first couple paintings?
I believe he just went to studios and asked if they would sell it for him, and of course, they probably denied him. They said, no, the thing's huge. Who's going to buy that, you know? So I don't know how he accomplished his first ones. It must be in some easy-to-look-up form or whatever, how he started to sell them. And I remember he sold them for $4,000, a painting that took months to accomplish and months to dry. I imagine at least 2 months to dry it. You know, under wrong conditions, you have to be able to have a nice, clear day that's either sunny or warm so it'll dry. And then he sold it for $4,000. So, you know, I imagine it was just like, wow, I'm going to make money off this thing. It's a joke. And he smoked like a chimney. He loved the chain smoke. In all of his films that shows him painting, he's got a cigarette in one hand and painting away, so I imagine the money went to buying cigarettes and different paints and stuff so they can accomplish the next one. You know, that was like any artist. He didn't really visualize profit off it. He just visualized, all right, I got to do this one more time. I imagine this amazing release from his psyche to see it accomplished. You know, like, all right, that one's done. And then to see it go away must have been kind of exciting, too.
Do you think his painting sold for the millions only after he died?
Yes. It became a period thing. It was the same as Impressionism, the same as French Realism or whatever. He became, in the 60s, the person that made that random art, the first one that was recognizable. And so I believe it was actually in his lifetime they came to him and said, hey, look, you know, this is a pattern and style of art that's like nothing else before or nothing else after, and we recognize it as being valuable. So I think before he passed on, he was able to say, well, you know, I want big money for it. And they said, okay, you know, we'll pay you whatever his value is for real instead of trying to burn him for it.
So that experience in the museum, staring at the Jackson Pollock, that had an influence on you, and also the big T-Rex display, and we're going to talk about those influences shortly.
Sure.
That had an influence on you. What are some other things during those early days in the museum that had an influence on you?
One of my favorite things in life is that silly movie, Oliver Twist. He's got Dodger, his best friend, and they go through England, you know, London, obviously, and they do things that are basically risky and wrong. You know, they work for a thief, basically, that shows them how to pickpocket and everything else. So I was influenced by their ability to get in and get out of tight, small places, to run from cops and to go underneath something that an adult couldn't go underneath to get away. So part of the museum experience was I'd be out there by myself, you know, we're walking around doing things by myself, and eventually you run into other kids that are in the museum with the same scenario. I see another kid, and he's crying, and I say, you know, did your mom and dad leave you here? Yeah, you know, so I says, well, why are you scared? You know, well, I'm nervous of this, that, people. So eventually we gathered together, and it became a thing where every couple days you would see the same kids, and I'd say, oh, wow, you're back, you know, and, yeah, you're back too, and so we would play tags. The thing to do was tag you're it and then run like hell from the kid, and then eventually we're running from the security because they're chasing us around. But I remember crawling underneath many an obstruction to keep an adult from going closer to the art, and I would crawl underneath the velvet ropes or underneath the cages or fences, whatever they had in front of it, and I would touch the paintings. That was one of my things, was to go up, and I didn't want to break them, but I would just feel the canvas's paint. I remember touching Monet's. I remember touching Pollock's. I remember touching the paintings that most people would never even get near, you know, saying, because arrests or whatever. So I remember doing that as a child. I would do a thing where you stand next to a door, and when an adult comes out, I could just simply step through the door, and the door closes behind me, and now I'm inside of wherever it was that you're not supposed to be. Because I was so small, they wouldn't even see me. I'm down below their view line, you know, so I'd walk into a room or whatever after they walked out. So I remember at one point going down into the archives of the Chicago Field Museum where they had the actual bones. I started to learn that the bones upstairs were models so that they can be reproduced. And if anything was to happen to them, whether they'd be destroyed or damaged or stolen or something, they have the real one downstairs in chilled archives where it's actually climate controlled, and they kept them under secured isolation for years to this day so they can maybe do DNA tests and everything else that they do now, and carbon dating and everything else, so they don't lose the bone upstairs to the possible threat of environmental damage. So I found myself in the archives of the museum saying, oh my God, look at this. And, you know, pulling out a drawer full of tiny little bones that was just fascinating to a kid. And I say, wow, look at all that. It's like a jigsaw puzzle, you know, and it makes one of those things upstairs. Wow. But anyway, so they have many, many things down their archives, and some of the art is even archived where they don't let you see the real stuff because of potential terrorist threats to it. You know, it becomes national treasure, so they don't want to lose it. So obviously I started to see that they had a different part of the museum that they don't let the general public see. That was real fascinating to me too. You know, even to this day, I'd love to go to the Smithsonian Institution. I would spend months or maybe a year there just to see all the stuff, and then also to try to see their archives so you can see the real stuff, you know, saying just like anything else. Whenever you see King Tut's exhibition or the crown jewels of England, they're never the real jewels. They're always something that's been duplicated so that it wouldn't be a threat to somebody destroying it or stealing it. And that actually led me to an interesting story, as I learned that they stole the Mona Lisa one time. They took the Mona Lisa off the wall and set it behind a radiator. A security guard did that. And when he put that behind the radiator, he then went out and sold to four different criminal entities. He sold an artificial replica of it. You know, he had rolled up a canvas and said, listen, I got the Mona Lisa right here. So four criminals, actually they're like syndicate mob leaders or whatever, bought the painting from him four times over, and that became one of the biggest scandals in history that was unreported by anybody because they couldn't report that they'd been ripped off by this guy. So eventually they probably tried to seek him out and take out his life or something for doing it, but I thought that was kind of interesting that they actually showed the Mona Lisa disappear for a few minutes.
So what happened to the real one?
Well, they found it eventually behind the radiator and took it out and hung it back on the wall. So in fact, it's not missing. But during that time that it was reported, and I'm sure it went out on the newsletters and everything, that the Mona Lisa's been stolen. That's actually the most recognized piece of art in the world. People see that and they know exactly what it's all about from every culture and every generation just appreciates what the effort is.
Tell that story like you were telling us it was originally a face of a man or something.
I believe he had gotten commissioned to paint a wife of a famous, I think it was a king or a prince or something, you know, wanted his wife painted. And he looked at the wife and says, oh my God, that's hideous. I don't want to paint her. So he made, I believe, a joke out of it, and he painted his face and then imposed her features onto it so that it was feminine. You know, he obviously was able to determine what makes up a feminine face and a masculine face. And I believe he became the first person to do a female impressionism, and that was so entertaining that even to this day, people pay millions of dollars and line up just to see it, you know, saying it's just amazing. And I heard from my roommate that went over and actually viewed the painting that it's on a stairwell so that you're not allowed to just linger in front of it. They want people to continually move past it because it's so sought after. People come to the museum just to see the piece. So they want them to continually move past it, so they have it on a staircase, so you have to go by it going up or down the stairs, and so you can't just stop in front of it and just admire it or take it in or whatever, because people like me would just be stuck there all day and just never move, trying to understand it or figure it out. And of course, they analyze it using today's forensics or whatever. They have a way by taking dimensional photos of it and analyzing it to determine what was painted first and what lines came second and third and stuff like that. And the guy that was into that concept of trying to dissect it using forensic evidence platforms, you know, like maybe the density of the paint or what colors went down and stuff like that, he couldn't determine what the first features were, but somehow or another, he turns the painting over and they superimpose something onto it, and suddenly it looks just like an actual UFO. Of all things, it looks like a potential unidentified flying disc of some kind. And I don't know if that's seeking out something that's there or that's not really there. But anyway, he's got a special on it. I remember seeing it on television, a wonderful special about what is the Mona Lisa. But anyway, that's a fascinating painting to me. It's one of those things that you say, wow, what makes it so popular? Why is it the number one painting in the world? How can I duplicate that? That was the thing. How can I make one of those? Because I was fascinated as a child in the museums. I wanted to get some bones. I wanted a skull. So I would ask the curators and the, you know, the guys that work there and the security and everything. I'd say, how do I get one of those bones? And they'd laugh and they'd say, that thing cost the museum $8 million, you know. You can't expect to get one of those, sons. Anyway, when I was very young, my dad was always trying to figure out some clever ways to keep me occupied and within view so he could tell if I'm doing anything wrong, because I was so mischievous as a kid. He would give me a shovel and a pick, give me a pith helmet. And I remember him saying, go out in the yard, the dinosaurs came from right here. You heard it at the museum. I said, yeah, they did. You know, they're right in the Chicago area. They found prehistoric bones or whatever. So he says, go find one in the yard. I think there's one out there. So I remember, I remember digging a hole. And I was a kid. I was probably about 6 or 7 years old at the time. And I started digging this hole, and I dug and I dug, and it hit something. You know, dink, you know, the old shovel hits. I was down below eye level, so I had to call down a ladder to get down in there. And it was a big hole. You know, it was probably about 5 or 6 feet long and 2 or 3 feet wide. You know, I was exploring. I was going down. You know, it was difficult to work with because it was hard pan and different elements of stones and stuff. And so I hit something big, and I started to do what they do on the television. You know, I started to use my toothbrush and brush away anything without damaging the item, you know. And I excavated this thing that looked like a big eye pocket in the bone. You know, to me, it was the same exact thing I'd seen in the museum. It was a big receded hole inside of a giant white element, you know, and I says, oh my God, I think I got something. So I'm out there digging away. My dad used to see the dirt shovel flying out of the hole, and he says, he's still in there. He's good to go. But anyway, so now I'm excited, and I cut as much as I could around it, and then I go in and I get my pops. I says, pops, I think I got something. He says, what? I think I found something. So he comes out there, and from standing above it, looking into the hole, you can see it's an outline of what looks like a giant white skull with the eye sockets and teeth and the whole thing. So he says, oh my God, the kid found something. My parents went to, I guess it was probably some university because my mother's connected, and they had somebody come out, and some archaeologist come out there, and he's going to take a look at this thing. And he went down in the hole with his tools and lights and stuff to see what it's about, and he come up and concluded that it's actually a big piece of quartz rock. But it's huge, you know what I'm saying? At the same time, it does have what looks like the eye socket. He's laughing. He says, man, that kind of fooled me at first, too. So he says, it's pretty interesting. And he asked my parents, can he pull that out of there? And so they came out with teams of people. I remember my mom taking a picture with her old camera that turned the things upside down or whatever. She took a shot of all the people above it. They had built a A-frame and way to hoist it out, you know, chains and everything else. And, you know, 20 students are out there trying to dig it out of there. So they were practicing to actually excavate a bone as if it was real. And when it came out, it was huge. So it was probably 4 feet by 3 feet by 2 feet big of quartz. And they had them elements on it that kind of looked like a bone. So they took it to some school or something. They took it to some library at some school and put it in front of it. And to this day, it's got some place in Chicago, I don't know where, but it sits out in front of the library where the kids can sit on it and enjoy it and explore it and stuff, but at the same time, it looks just like a skull. And a part of it was to put my picture in the story with it somehow.
Oh, that's a great story.
It's so funny. My parents are laughing. To this day, my mom looks at the picture, I guess, and she says, I remember you found a bone one. That's okay. Whatever, Mom.
Let me ask you this. What kind of lessons did you learn from your mom about making money, and what's your earliest memory of making your first dollar on your own?
Okay, so what I did was I found out from my mother or thank God she was adapt, because they thought I was just a slow student at school. I was retarded or something. You know, back in the day, they had names for it. So they wanted to just X me out of the class or put me to the back of the room and pass me by. And because I have dyslexia, many famous people have or whatever. One of them, I can't remember the name of the actor.
No, very common. So you could not make grade. You had dyslexia. They didn't know what you had, so they just thought you were dumb.
I had a problem with seeing words upside down and backwards, you know, seeing the letters jumbles. Tom Cruise is the name I was thinking. Tom Cruise has the same exact affliction. And what they do with Tom Cruise is they never make him study a script. He simply method acts. He goes and lives with the person he's going to duplicate, and then he method acts his personality, and eventually they write the movie around him so that he doesn't have to learn any lines. I thought that was fascinating. I said, there it is right there. And so my scenario was I couldn't read that well, and I couldn't retain the information correctly, and so I was unable to learn by direction, let's say a planned direction of put slot A into slot B. That just didn't work with me, and I couldn't learn by somebody telling me what to do. Hey, look, Mike, put that thingamajig and that thingamajig over there. That didn't work either, but as soon as you showed me how to do something, then I was on it. As soon as they do it themselves, then I would record it, and I'd say, I could do that. So I got to the point where I can actually do amazing things that would blow people away, because I said, damn, the kid can't tie his shoes, but he could do that.
Did your mom recognize you at this?
Yes, and she went immediately to the school and said, hey, look, my kid's special, and he's better than all the kids here you'll see someday, but don't jerk him around because he can't read from a book, you know what I'm saying? Just show him what you want and watch him do it. He'll do better than you. So I remember many a times, you know, they'd instruct me by just showing me what to do, and then pretty soon I'm in front of the class showing the class exactly what to do in just a matter of minutes, and the teachers were impressed with that. They said, wow, he really does catch on quick if you use his method to teach him. And one of the first, I believe, in the schools of Chicago to understand that there's a potential that you just don't want to just throw him aside and just blow him off because he can't read or write, you know what I'm saying? So don't do that, you know. So eventually I excelled. I actually was set back for the year when I was 7 years old. I was in second grade twice, and my parents were embarrassed that I had to go do it again, and it didn't work the second time. I still wasn't able to read or write. They realized what it was and studied it and found out, and then suddenly I caught up to the class, and I didn't have to go to 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. I went from 5th grade to 9th grade, and I got to pass up 3 grades, and I graduated the 3rd youngest student to ever come out of the school, and I just turned 17 when I graduated.
What was the high school called?
It was called Hudson Bay High School. And to me, I just wanted to get out of it sooner because schools intimidated me to the point where I would get anxiety from it. You know, I said, oh, God, I got to do this and stand in front of that, and I know I'm going to be embarrassed. Even to this day, I have a hard time when somebody shoves a piece of paper at me and says, here, tell me the directions to this or that, and I'll misspell a word, and it's frustrating. Thank God for now computers where they have the spelling check. I love that, you know. I'd use that to text on a phone. I'll text on a phone, and I can't get the word right, and it won't show up right. It won't correct on my phone, so I'll go to my computer real quick and open it up and type it in, and I'll show either examples or what I'm looking for, and I can put that into my text message. It's kind of silly, but it's a lifesaver for folks like myself that can't deal with the correct spelling on things.
All right, how did you get to Vancouver? You were in Chicago. Did you guys move around because of your dad?
Yeah, well, my pops, he's an inventor. He was an artist. He painted art, and he wanted to be an inventor, and it was his life is kind of, you know, a little bit foolish, whatever. And my mother just got fed up with it. She says, look, none of your paintings sold. He paid 3,000 paintings. None of them sold, and he couldn't get any effort going with that. And none of his invention worked. He'd invented over 3,000 different items. So finally he says, okay, I'll get a job. He went to work for Mattel Incorporated, and I don't know what he actually, he worked something to do with the production in the tools and dye sales of different things to make products. And so he would then come home with different new toys. And I remember him pushing a stopwatch one time, you know, he'd hand me a toy and he'd stopwatch, he'd click and then see how long it was before a piece broke or before I lost a piece or before I ate a piece or before the thing would fall apart or before I would get disinterested in it. You know, I'd put it down and say, this is stupid, you know, and this is a ridiculous toy. So anyway, so he brought home many a toy. There were prototypes that weren't even on the market yet. And then he'd come back to the work, I'm sure, and then he would have a report to them and show where the failings were. So they would then redesign the product so that piece wouldn't fall out or make it safe or whatever they had to do to keep up with production. So that became an important part. They'd send home different things to the little crazy Mike or whatever, and he'd figure out how to break the thing, you know. So I was really good at taking things apart and not being able to put them back together. So they kind of took advantage of that. My dad says, you know, let my kid have it. He'll figure it out, you know, no time at all. So he brought home one time a creepy crawler machine. I don't know if you remember what that is.
Yeah, I remember the creepy crawler.
Yeah, so I had molds, and they brought home this thing, and they had goop. They poured goop into it. And so I was excited about it. I just found that toy just fascinating. You could cook it in a little oven. And just very soon, because I had this artistic thing in my head, I would take the molds and I would paint different colored goops into different elements of it. I'll give a quick example. They had a little shrunken head. Its lips were sewn together with thread. And I would paint the threads black, and I'd pour in different mixtures of the goop so that the skin tones were right. And it'd come out with pink and purple and, you know, orange and all these different things mixed together so that the skin tones were like real skin tones. And eventually it had little eyes that were shut, and I'd make those blue or black so that it looked like it's been beat on, you know, and ravished. But by the time it was done, it looked like a real shrunken head. I could fool people with my art in the mold making. The process was to put some paint down in there first and then cook it a little bit, some goop, and then the next level, and pretty soon they had multi-layers of different colors so they could be very accurate. I had spiders that had glow-in-the-dark fangs and white hair on its top of its black tarantula body, you know what I'm saying? So eventually they became more and more realistic. So I would take those to school, and the kids loved them. The first one I ever showed, I was, you know, scaring the girls with a spider or something, and all the kids had to have, oh, God, we want that. We have to have one, Mike. And at the time, I was very young. I was only 7, and I start to sell them for nominal cost, a dime, you know, 15 cents, I think, or 25 cents was my most expensive one. And then eventually I turned to my dad and says, hey, Dad, these things are really great. Can I get more? So he came home with 10 more different sets that they had. They had army men. They had cars that you can make. They had rings and things and different Halloween. Each one was a different set of molds with its own oven. So eventually I had 10 different sets with 100 different molds. And I would cook in my room and stuff, and eventually I had 10 different ovens plugged into the same outlet, so it was real risk for fire and stuff. And eventually I was selling so many of them, I had so much production going that I had to hire kids that were in my class to come home and make them with me. I says, look, first do this and then this. And so I had a production line, a little assembly line in my room. And my pops comes in one day, and the room's all full of smoke, and I'm sure we're inhaling all the wrong stuff.
Yeah.
And he says, listen, this isn't safe. So here, let's work in the garage, and we're going to open the door. And it's freezing cold in Chicago. Mm. So anyway, so he says, we're going to make this thing so that it works right. So he went out and purchased, it was actually a grill out of a restaurant. I believe it was a gas-powered grill that can cook 144 molds at once. It was 12 molds wide and 12 molds long, so I could cook 144 of them at one time. And I'd use a 2x4 to slide them into the water. They'd fall off the grill into the water, and I'd put the next line of them up there, and we'd start the process all over on each row. So I was cranking them out by the thousands. I actually had like 10,000 units sometime. And I would take them to school, and I was selling them left and right. And the kids would come back with stories. Oh, I scared my sister with this little worm or whatever, but my mom took it away, or my dog ate it, or I need another one. And so they'd come back over and over to buy the same product from me. I thought that was great. You know, I had like a built-in resale ability with it. You know, and at some point, I'm ordering through the company, and UPS is showing up to my house with 20 cases of this goop. You know, and the guy's, you know, he's got a bill for $500. I'm giving my mother $500, and she's making a check so they can write it out to do the purchase for the materials. And it just went crazy. You know, at some point, I was selling them left and right to adults, and down the road, I was peddling them like a crazy kid. And I went to school one day, and I was selling them at school like always. And the principal called me in the office and says, look, we got a problem. And I said, what's going on? He says, you've taken every child's money for lunch. Yeah, at the cafeteria today, there is zero money in the boxes because you've taken all the money. And my locker was full of quarters and stuff. I remember my pockets are full of change. So I couldn't deny it. I says, well, I thought that's what we're supposed to do is learn how to make money. And he says, well, how's the cafeteria supposed to survive? I said, well, that's not my problem. You figure that out, you know. So they called my parents. They're going to throw me out of school. They're going to expel me for 3 days for it, and they're going to discipline me. And my parents showed up in rage, you know. So my dad wasn't about to have none of that. My kid isn't going to get thrown out of school for doing something that you're teaching them how to do. So they went down there with a different attitude. I was exed out of the room while they had a discussion, and I can hear him screaming like hell. My dad's a Marine DI, I remind you, you know, so he wasn't about to put up with nothing, you know. So eventually they had to let me back in the school. They couldn't allow the kid to be kicked out for that. I think there was a threat of a lawsuit or something, and they said, okay, you're back in school, but you can't do this anymore. Don't sell any kids these products or whatever, which my dad thought was wrong because, you know, you're teaching them how to do it. So anyway, so I would take them across the street before school started, and I'd pour them on the ground and have a great time. I still took all the money from the cafeteria, so I'm back in again, and they said, hey, look, you know, I said, well, I'm not doing it at school. I'm across the street. What do you want? So eventually they had to make up what they called the Free Enterprise Day. We're going to let you do this one day a year, and all the kids get to build whatever they want, sell whatever they want, and what we'll do is we'll have the kids exchange money for script so that way it's not cash at school. Like some sort of stipulation that they couldn't trade cash value at school. So we bought script, and then you could take your script and go around the cafeteria or on the gym, and all the kids had tables set up for whatever product they had. I remember most of the kids had things you can eat or whatever, you know, a lot of brownies and cookies and shit like that. And a few of them had things that they had made with different crafts or whatever. And I had my creepy crawlers, and I had now converted them into keychains. And I had paper clips, I had pins behind them so you could use them on your lapel, and I'd figured out different ways of incorporating elements into it so that it'd hang on and fasten better to whatever adults wanted. So I had tie clips that were spiders and the whole thing. And what I did is at the end of the day, I had taken every piece of script at the whole entire event, you know, so I had everybody's money in my hand, and then I cashed it all in. I can't remember, it was probably thousands of dollars, probably $1,000 at least, but I'd taken everybody's script, and my dad was real proud that, see, the kid came up with a product that everybody wanted to have one, and I believe even the principal ended up with one of the tie clips. So the idea was I outsold everybody and even gained the trust of the school and everything else. So at that point, I was kind of satisfied with the whole thing, and I didn't sell them at school anymore. I tried to take them down the road. I started peddling them at different businesses, and I found myself at a place that sells bait and tackle. And I also sold them to the Ace Hardware. They put boxes of them on their shelves, and I would put a sample on the box and a little sign above it that says they're a quarter, and they made half or something off every sale. And I took it to the bait shop and tackle shop, and the guy wanted thousands of them. He wanted pieces made with grasshoppers with fish hooks in them. You know, can you put a fish hook in there, son? And I said, I sure can.
Now, back then, did bait and tackle stuff have this rubber type?
No, it was the first thing. And he was on it. He realized that he was the first one. And so I believe he took it to advertisement and everything else. He used it as a concept to sell to other bait and tackle shops. He wasn't a fool. He says, I'm going to sell this around the city, you know, and get other people involved. Because it was a worm that had a hook in the back of it, and it looked like a real worm. It was absolutely correct in all the physical elements because I was into the paint make it right thing. So they were all the right colors. I'm sure to a fish that that's a real item, you know. And at the same time, they're very durable. They're rubber. They can put it underwater, salt water, whatever you had. So he was onto it. He ordered thousands of them. I want 10,000 grasshoppers, 10,000 worms. And so I would go home and start in production. I said,
how old are you now?
Yeah, I was 8. At that time, Pops, I need more molds. I need more goop. This guy wants a big thing of it, you know.
That's the end of part 1 of Garage Sale Mike's interview. Please continue to part 2.